Parenthood is one of life's most beautiful and demanding callings, but for parents raising a child on the autism spectrum, that journey can come with unique questions, deep emotions, unexpected challenges, and profound moments of love and growth. Today on Vital Voices, we sit down with husband and wife Marcus Boslin and Paula Maria Hospitalis Boslin for a gentle and honest conversation about what it has meant to raise a child with autism, while also parenting another child with different needs, hopes, and milestones. Their story is not just about diagnosis, therapy, school, or support systems. It is about family, it is about marriage, and it is about learning to advocate, adjusting expectations, celebrating progress, and discovering strength in the day-to-day journey. This is a conversation with parents, families, educators, churches, communities, and anyone who wants to better understand how to support families navigating autism with passion, patience, and love.
Vital Voices is a production of Tag Studios and is proudly brought to you each week by our sponsor, Wellspring Lifestyle Group, where you can find freedom and transformation through whole person health.
Vital Voices.
Welcome to Vital Voices, the podcast where we amplify the stories, insights, and expertise of the people shaping the future of our communities, our conversations, and our country. I'm your host, Alexis Burrows. Thank you for joining us. Today's episode is a deeply personal and meaningful conversation on navigating parenthood with an autistic child. We are joined by husband and wife Marcus Boslin and Paula Maria Hospitalis Boslin, who will be sharing from their lived experience as parents of two children, one child on the autism spectrum, now 17 and attending a special needs school, and another child, now 21, who's in college. This conversation is intended to be thoughtful, respectful, and gentle. Autism is not a single story, and every family's journey is different. Today, we are not here to define autism through one lens, but to listen, learn, and better understand what love, advocacy, family balance, and resilience can look like in real life. So Marcus and Paula, thank you so much for being here and trusting us with your family's story.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely.
I want to start with is, you know, just tell us a little bit about your family and I guess share a little bit about your children.
Sure. We're a family of four. Me, my wife, and two kids. Our kids are now, as you hinted, quite old. They're almost adults. Our oldest is 21, and our autistic youngest son is 17, soon to be 18, actually. So they're pretty big. We've been extremely active in the community. You did speak a little hint about it. You know, we have very, very active lives. Mm-hmm. And our kids have pretty active lives as well. Our youngest has perhaps the least active life, but even he tries to get out, and sometimes he's a little more busy than us.
Yeah. When would you say that you first began to notice that, you know, your younger son may have been developing, communicating, or responding to the world differently?
I think it was quite early, probably about 9 months. He didn't like a lot of eye contact. Mm-hmm. Even as a young baby, he preferred to be fed and put down, whereas our older son was, you know, wanted to be held and to be coddled a little bit more. But mm-hmm. Obasi was different. Marcus, what about, when do you think that you kind of noticed differences?
That's the right timeline. I always thought that kids needed to learn to swim. And I do vividly remember when I'm getting our youngest familiar with the water. At around 9 months, he started to turn away from me, because obviously I'm holding him in the water. Mm-hmm. But like the closeness, the connection was uncomfortable to him. So he liked the water, he loves the water, still does. But he used to demand essentially to turn away from me, which was quite unusual. And honestly, I did not recognize that at all at the time as a sign that he may have had autism. I had no clue. Mm-hmm. But I do remember thinking, you know, this is a little strange, because, you know, the other kids would, you know, grab me, you know, they're climbing all over you. You know, kids are in the water. Even mm-hmm. at that kind of baby age, they're very playful. And he was playful too, but he refused to maintain that eye contact.
Right. What was the journey like from, I guess, to diagnosis for your family, both emotionally and practically? Because we're talking now, you're going back, I imagine, somewhere between, you know, 12, 15 years. What was that process like, and how did you navigate that, both from a practical standpoint and an emotional standpoint?
Okay, so from a practical standpoint, he was in nursery when he was younger, mm-hmm. a baby. and because we both worked, and they started giving us a little feedback that maybe he didn't have enough words, you know, maybe there may maybe something not quite right. That kind of moved to us discovering that he did have bilateral hearing loss.
Mm-hmm.
He got air tubes put in, and what was significant for me is that once the tubes were in and he recovered from the surgery, any words that he had, he lost. I think it was because it was overstimulation, hearing everything after it was muffled before. But I guess, Marcus, did that go straight into allergies and determining what foods he had sensitivities to?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think really a pediatrician or doctors were trying to rule out physical causes,
right?
His lack of language. So we did all sorts of stuff with his hearing. We did allergy tests, and he was in fact allergic to a whole heap of foods. It kind of runs in our families, both our families. So you know, that by itself was useful for other reasons. We did the allergy tests, and in the end, after maybe.
It was about 20 months.
Months and months of investigations.
Yeah.
It was suggested that he might have autism, and then we started down a new diagnostic track, trying to ensure that he got a diagnosis, and it was clear that he was autistic. That by itself is quite complicated because there are no definitive tests per se.
Mm-hmm.
It's observational.
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to assess whether you have autism or not. But, you know, I think by the point in time where we were trying to procure autism diagnosis, it both became pretty clear because by that time he was, you know, relatively old.
Two and a half.
Yeah, still not speaking. And displaying other characteristics.
Yeah, so a little flapping, a little stimming.
Mm-hmm.
But from an emotional standpoint, my background, Marcus and I even spoke about it again last night. My background, my mother was a speech therapist.
Oh.
And part of a lot of her practice dealt with this emerging autism situation. And so I have been around children and young people with autism practically from the time I was 12, maybe. And so for me, it wasn't so much emotional, it's just trying to find the best way forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My wife is very much a fix-it woman.
Yeah.
So okay.
Something to be done, she rolls up her sleeves and tries to get it done.
Yeah. I think it's helpful to kind of have that background as well, because it kind of gives you a little bit of a leg up in terms of understanding and, you know, being a little bit, not necessarily prepared per se, but probably a little bit better prepared than somebody who's just coming at it, you know, completely blind.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I don't want to give the wrong impression. There is a sadness,
mm-hmm.
a feeling of loss when you have a diagnosis of autism. I mean, the expectation when you have kids, you know, you have this list of things that you're going to do and they're going to be, and how your life will operate.
And mm-hmm.
so it's just, it is a matter of maybe just shifting and accepting the child that is in front of you.
Right. Especially depending on
vision of the child that you had.
Right. And especially depending on, you know, how far on the spectrum they are as well.
Right.
Because obviously, you know, you have varying degrees of where children.
Right. So now they're down to a 3 scale. There's level 1,
mm-hmm.
which can be people who can operate fairly typically in schools and the workforce with minimal assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And level 2, somebody who's going to need a little bit more help. He is level 3, which is more profound.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're different situations as you move along the levels, of course.
Yeah. You know, looking back at it now, what do you wish you had known in those early years?
You know, if to me, just the sense that, you know, it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the perhaps the, you know, our son is 2 years,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, he's going to change in the same way everybody else changes, but, you know, he is always going to be different. And, you know, accepting that and being okay with that and, you know, not stressing unduly about that,
mm-hmm.
I think is extremely powerful.
Yeah.
And that's not to say you don't take the steps required to ensure that your child has the best possible outlook, right? But that's stuff you do for any child. Typical child, you try to figure out, you know, what can I do to help this child achieve their fullest potential? But, you know, at the same time, just recognizing that, you know, you can be happy and healthy and well-adjusted as a child and now a young adult, as we do have, despite being profoundly autistic and despite needing care for the rest of your life, right? You know, there's still a lot of positive that can come from that.
There's still a lot of joy.
Mm-hmm.
There's still, you know, laughter and good times.
This is true, because I mean, I guess at the end of the day, you kind of you learn to navigate it, and like you said, you appreciate the child that you have. Mm-hmm. And you kind of go from there, understanding that there, like you said, there is some sadness over, you know, what you come in when you have a baby and you have these expectations of what you're going to see and what's going to happen. And then that does shift. But at the same time, you know, this is your child that you both brought into this world together, and you love and you support and you figure it out together.
Absolutely.
And for sure, I mean, an autism diagnosis is going to be on no one's list of mm-hmm. plan for outcomes with the child.
Yeah.
It is certainly not something that's desirable, right?
Yeah.
But and you have to let go of the thoughts that you had before and accept what you have now.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, once you can do that, there's a great amount of power and freedom that comes from that, and letting go of what thoughts you had in your mind
mm-hmm.
Really allow you to be the best parent that you can be.
Yeah. You know, thank you for sharing that, because I think, you know, many parents can relate to the uncertainty of those early moments, those early years, especially when they're trying to understand, you know, what their child needs and how best to support them. And I think that's helpful for people to understand that it is a little bit scary. It is a little bit, you know, you kind of working on the fly, trying to figure it out. And life becomes a very different and interesting journey. You know, trying to help, I guess, you know, our audience understand having a child on the spectrum from the parent's perspective, you know, for families who may not fully understand autism, you know, you mentioned that your son is level 3. How would you describe what autism looks like in his life?
Go ahead, Marcus.
So our son is, you know, he has some typical behavior in mm-hmm. that he often flaps his hands. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of kinetic motion with our son. Like, he has to do something at all times. So he'll be sitting down and he'll be just shaking his hands. Sometimes with a piece of clothing in his hands, he's shaking it. And he does that consistently. He is, I think, unusually active
mm-hmm.
as a child. So I think that is part of him that may not be that typical. I think it's more him than mm-hmm. the autism in him. He jumps up from the chair instead of just slowly getting up from the chair. He runs around the house, which, to be honest, is something I used to do as a child too.
And let's not forget our firstborn was quite active as well.
Very active, mm-hmm. still active. So he is easily the noisiest person,
the loudest person in the house.
Yeah, by quite the distance. But you know, he is also capable of just relaxing. Mm-hmm. He loves using his iPad. He'll go on YouTube for hours on end, and he often does that quietly. He loves playing with his, we have a few puzzles that he plays with. He loves playing with those puzzles. It's a nice little mental workout for him too.
Mm-hmm.
But so, he also likes to spend time with us. So yes. If we are sitting down watching a show, he wants to be sitting with us, preferably head on one person, legs on the other person. Just, he likes the physical touch now. Mm-hmm. The eye contact is much different from when he was 9 months. He'll look you in the face and look you in the eye and, pick up little things. And, sometimes when we're just sitting and even in the quiet moments, he'll just turn and smile at us because, he's like, yeah, y'all all right.
And at the same time, he doesn't like physical touch. So he's one that will hug you and then push you away, mm-hmm. only to immediately hug you again.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like he has an ambivalence
mm-hmm.
about those close connections. But Sydney has gotten a lot more warm and expressive physically than he was when he was small.
Yeah.
I imagine it's like he is almost like he wants the contact, but on his terms. So it's like when he wants it and when he doesn't, he doesn't. But I will tell you though, kids just like to sleep, lay on their parents. That is everybody everywhere.
That's so typical.
If you catch my son slipping and legs will be on your head, you'll have a knee in your nose. It's just, this is how kids are. Obviously, when you navigate the world, when you have a child who's autistic, your family is one thing. I imagine you create a very safe space. But as you go out into the world, sometimes it's more difficult for people to appreciate, the gifts, the characteristics, the personality of someone who is on the spectrum. What are some of the things that you wish that more people could see of him first before like the autism and any, prejudice or prejudgment that may come along?
We live in a society where people snap judge you just on first sight. And so oftentimes there's stares. And what I would like the public to know, I prefer you come and you ask me a question.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just stare.
Yeah.
I prefer... You reach out as opposed to, me having to be going a staring contest now because what you staring at?
Mm-hmm.
I really feel, but honestly, over the years, I think it's gotten a lot bit better. There, we'd go into a store that we haven't been in and the cashier will go, does he have autism? My nephew my friend's son and so it's opening up a bit, but there's still some people who are inappropriate. Like what's wrong with him is not an opening gamble.
And I think, we culturally, and this is, here and across the Caribbean, I think we tend to be very, we like to hide when there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. Especially if it's something where like you're neurodivergent or if you have, even if it's like a physical ailment, if you're in a wheelchair, things like that, like we tend to do this thing where you will never know because the family will just hide that child or that family member away. And so I feel like and it's not to give people a pass, but this is why they don't know how to act because you for so long you didn't see it. Now, I do think that, this is where the work of organizations like REACH and things like that become so important. Yes. And even conversations like this one is because people get to hear and understand and realize that, hey, this is a conversation that we can have, and people are getting better. I'm sure there's still a long way to go, but people are getting better at understanding.
They are getting better.
Being, more compassionate. Like that was the word that Greer mentioned. It was like we have to find a way to be compassionate just because someone is different. And we might not understand that difference. And we might look at it because she was like somebody, the child's just rude or they're just this or they're just that. And she's like, no, that.
Yeah, I've gotten that we need to discipline him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I imagine it's a rough road. But I do it think.
And you know what is sad about it? Because one of the things that you said, people don't like to know that somebody in their family is on the autism spectrum. But the sad thing is early intervention is key.
Yes.
And the longer you wait, the harder it is for that individual to reach their full potential.
Mm-hmm. Especially if there's a possibility, like if they're on the lower end of the spectrum where, you know, like you said, they can live a mostly typical life. Then if you mm-hmm. if you're able to discover, we have this thing where it's like, oh, I'm not claiming that, and that's not my son or that's not my daughter, yes. and it's such a strange yeah. thing, because in every area and element of medicine and healthcare, everyone preaches it. Early intervention, early diagnosis is most helpful, and it's the same whether it's cancer, whether it's heart disease, or whether it's autism. It's the exact same yep. approach.
And actually, what I tell, sometimes I come across parents who have received a fresh diagnosis and mm-hmm. their child is young, you know, preschooler. And I always tell them, I say, listen, you don't, if the label is problematic for you, you don't have to label it.
Fair.
But you do have to get some help. Because regardless to what it is, if your child maybe, you know, was having problem with math or had difficulty spelling, you will work with that child to kind of boost that skill. So if mm-hmm. your child is having issues with language, you know, you could try different things, or you don't even have to label it, but you just get the help that you need.
Yeah.
In the internet world, honestly, mm-hmm. you could get some good interventions to help you do small things, little things at home that can make a big difference.
Yeah. What would you say, and I guess both of you could kind of answer this from your own perspective, but what would you say have been some of the more difficult parts of parenting a child on the spectrum, especially as he's grown into being a teenager?
You know, autism affects learning.
Mm-hmm.
So many things that children typically learn quickly. It takes a long time with someone on the autism spectrum. Certainly potty training took a long time for our son.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Literally.
And yes. And you know, it's very difficult as a parent, because you know, you're trying to consistently give the right lesson and show him exactly what he has to do and so on. But it takes a tremendous amount of time. And that goes for pretty much every aspect of his life, right? It takes a long time to get from point A to point B. So it really does require patience
mm-hmm.
and perseverance.
And consistency.
To get even simple things down. The good thing is, you know, there's a sort of routine around people with autism. You know, they get it, even though they that's not to say they won't lapse every once in a while, but they get into their routines and that does save them. But it really does require a great deal of patience.
Yeah. But Paulo, sorry, what about you?
I think a lot of people think they grow out of it. So you know Marcus. Marcus is over 6 feet and so is Obasi.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're not expecting the autism in that package
mm-hmm.
and the behavior in that package.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a little bit more challenging, even for me to control him sometimes if he's having some difficulty, because mm-hmm. it's a larger child, mm-hmm. it's a larger person.
Yeah.
But, you know, we try, you know, in times when it's difficult, it's a two-person job. Mm-hmm. Marcus and I'll say, Marcus, I really just need 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I will go away.
Yeah. Nah, I've seen recent photos and I'm like, no, Ossie is big. Like he's like his dad. He's a big boy. Yeah. And so I imagine if you're having you know, a difficult moment, a meltdown, you know, it can be very very interesting to manage, especially for you, Paulo, because he's, I imagine, a lot bigger than you.
Yeah, he's a lot bigger than me. But one thing about him, he's generally a sweet child. So I think even in his meltdowns afterwards, he looks like he's sorry. You know, he's mm-hmm. apologetic. He's kind of like, don't be mad at me. You know, there's that kind of like, I couldn't help it.
There's an understanding, you know, that he has. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, we work with him as best we can.
Yeah. Marcus, you know, you mentioned education being learning being a big part of this. And obviously now, Obasi is 17. Mm-hmm. and he's in a special needs school. How has school shaped his development, confidence, routine, sense of belonging? Like, how has that helped? Because I know that's a space where a lot of people have concerns and trepidation, you know. So, you know, what would you say to that area of it?
I mean, having him in a school is absolutely critical. And he's going to be in school, even though he's 17, he's going to be in school for a while. It gives him a sense of purpose. It gives him a structure, a routine. And that by itself is absolutely vital. You know, you mentioned the past where people with autism have essentially nowhere to go. They were essentially shut into the house. And, you know, that even though they are not the most social people, that kind of environment is really not particularly healthy for anybody. People need social interactions, even if it's different types of interaction. And school presents a safe place where you can learn some foundational things. Now, in a special needs school, everyone's sort of curriculum is different because every child is different, and has very different skills and abilities, and even different interests. Certainly, there are things that Obasi is just simply not interested in doing, and he makes that abundantly clear to his teachers and us. So you know, so in terms of what he's doing, it's quite different to pretty much everybody else in the class. But they still do some things together, which really gives us some things that we can work on at home as well. Because at home, then we're just sort of reinforcing certain things that he learns in school, as opposed to having to figure it all out ourselves.
So, you know, speaking of support, obviously the school would be a part of this, but what kinds of support have made the biggest difference for Obasi as your child, but also for you guys as a family over the years?
I think one of the biggest things, and I always say, is Obasi has an aid. And that has made our lives a lot easier. Because you know, you mentioned about trepidation about children on the spectrum being in school. So he's not alone in the classroom. He does have somebody who is assigned to him and who makes sure that he is well accommodated and you know, will understand his little tics and his little, oh, he needs to use the bathroom. And so people always think that she's a mind reader, but she, you know, she's gotten to know his little, oh no, it's too hot, or, you know, he needs to move a little bit. So that has been huge. But I don't want to downplay therapy. He has been in ABA, Applied Behavioral Analysis, and occupational therapy. And those two things really have made a difference as well.
Yeah. One thing I think I would want to add is that REACH has given us community and allowed us to make contact with parents who are similarly situated with autistic children.
Adults.
Gives us a sense that, you know, you're not in this alone. There's some community. And they've also created community for the children, because they do things, activities and other things, therapy and so on for the children as well. So there's a great deal of, I'm very, very grateful for, you know, helping us know more about autism, know more about parenting someone with autism, and also create an environment where you can connect with other parents and share experiences and thoughts and so on. So, just knowing that there's someone else out there similarly situated as you, traveling the same road as you, is extremely valuable.
Yeah, and then it also gives you a place of community.
But you know what it also does for Obasi? Like, when his group of young adults comes together, there is an ease in his movements when he is around the other young people who are on the spectrum, because they recognize each other for, you know,
yeah,
like, you know, he goes in and the ones who are more verbal will be, oh, Basi, how you doing? And, you know, he'll come across and high five because, you know, that's his people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something to be said for community, even within, not just for the parents, but also for the young people.
Yeah, because it's you're with people who understand and, yeah. you know, have faced similar challenges. Mm-hmm. And therefore there's a relationship, there's a community that comes there that they probably don't find anywhere else. And,
yes.
you know, one of the things that we have a sense of belonging and need for companionship and need for community. So yes. having one that feels comfortable and safe, both mm-hmm. for you as the parents and the family, but also for him being on the spectrum, I imagine is critical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices. We're going to take a quick break for some words from our sponsors and we'll be right back.
Have you been searching for healing, but still feeling stuck? Maybe it's stress, fatigue, long COVID symptoms, fibroids, high blood pressure, or perhaps a condition no one can fully explain. At Wellspring Lifestyle Group, we believe healing is body, soul, and spirit, with Christ at the center and practical evidence-based steps you can actually follow. Our approach is grounded in faith, backed by science and fueled by testimony. Start your journey to freedom today with the free Thrive 360 Holistic Wellness Checkup at wellspringlifestylegroup.com. In minutes, you'll get a head start on your journey. Wellspring Lifestyle Group, freedom and transformation through whole person health.
Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation. You know, let's tap into the conversation about, you know, the siblings part of it. You know, you obviously you have an older child who is not on the spectrum, and he's now in college. You know, what was it like?
Almost done.
And he's almost done. What was it like navigating having a child that's on the spectrum and one that's not?
You know, in a way, for us, we sort of had to divide and conquer.
Mm.
Through different parts of our children's life, Paula would take one kid, I would take the other, because, you know, they have very different needs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, you know, that has been, it's really required teamwork
yeah.
to make sure that both of them get the right kind of attention. Now, you know, do we always get the balance right? You know, it's hard to tell.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with two parents, two kids, you know, You got a decent shot.
Yeah, there's some balance there that helps.
Yeah. And you know, in parts of our lives, our older son Masana has been the star of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Masana has after he gave up soccer, which is his dad's sport, and went into swim.
Mm-hmm.
He developed into a pretty good decent. Swimmer.
Yeah, he's a big swimmer.
Mm-hmm. And through that, he's sort of played a central role in our lives that has always gotten, he's always had that as sort of
as his thing.
His thing.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, in a way, that has helped Tobasi as well, because we've been going to swim meets for a little more than a decade now, all over the world, US, Canada, Suriname, Barbados, one or two other places. And you know, he's sitting, you know, at first, for Basi, that the noise of mm-hmm. A swim stadium was nearly intolerable. But he's at the point now, even though every once in a while he tells us to sit down or something like that, he's at the point now where he's quite used to the environment. He goes, he sits down and stands with us. He, you know, he watches the swim. He sees his brother. He cheers.
Yeah.
Sometimes at the appropriate time. And you know, he's grown more social in
yes.
part by just because, you know, the ritual that we've had of attending these swim meets
yeah.
A couple of months.
Because it's
and then all the swimmers know him, and all the parents know him, and mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, yeah. So although my big son is out of the local scene for a little while, you know, whenever we go back to the pool, you know, they're surely parents who know Basi,
mm-hmm.
who've been seeing him from when he was a little tiny boy running up and down the stairs, which he used to do a lot when he was younger, to this big boy now, and admiring how tall he's grown and so on, and really knowing his journey. So in a way, the swim community has been observers and really part of his growth and development.
Yeah.
And it's another place where you can make some connection and they understand him for the local swim community understands him for having seen him for so long.
Yeah. How would you say that you helped Masana understand Obasi's needs while also making sure that he felt seen, supported, and prioritized? Because, you know, I had a conversation with another parent recently who has a kid on the spectrum, and her thing was, you know, I have to fight to make sure that, you know, my kid that's not on the spectrum doesn't feel like, you know, my kid who is on the spectrum gets all the attention and all the focus and all the energy, because there's this natural inclination that because of whether it's the tics or the meltdowns or those parts of it, that there's a natural draw there. But how did you guys help Masana to kind of understand that as a sibling to his brother?
Right. The one thing about Masana, from the moment he met Obasi, it was love.
Mm-hmm.
And he, as an individual, is very caring and very conscious about, well, because he's known Obasi from the time he was 3 years old, you know, just about autism and that kind of stuff. So Masana really does well with Obasi. I often tell people Obasi's favorite person is Masana. And that shows it, there's no two ways about it. You know, that's his dude and vice versa. But, you know, I want to say this so that parents don't feel we don't always get 50-50 between the kids. It's an impossibility. It's even if you had two typical children, you're not giving both of them the same amount. And so Masana has been very understanding. There have been times when, you know you're not given all that you can give, but that's as much as you have at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will go and apologize. I know you wanted me to do this and I didn't get a chance because of Obasi. But, you know, we apologize to him. We try to make it up, you know, but they just life. You it's never going to be 50-50.
Mm-hmm. I guess going a little bit deeper into the sibling relationship, because obviously you said that if you ask Obasi, you can tell that Masana is his favorite person in the world.
Absolutely.
What has that relationship, though, taught you about love, patience, protection, and understanding? Because I imagine, especially with Masana being the bigger brother and this being his younger brother and navigating the world as well, and that unconditional love that you see, like, what has that taught you guys as parents about this idea of love through interesting and difficult circumstances?
You know, one thing that's interesting is that, you know, because Obasi doesn't talk much at all,
mm-hmm.
but he is so expressive what he wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just says that, you know, sometimes you look for the other people in your lives to say something.
Mm-hmm.
And by waiting for that, you're missing what they're saying by their actions.
Yeah.
And other things, right? And it really is a good reminder that we use all sorts of different ways to communicate. And it's all saying something. And if it is you disregard the nonverbal forms of communication, you're missing something.
You're missing a lot.
Both in terms of the giving and the receiving. And you know, he finds his ways to just let you know if he's frustrated or tired or feeling strange or in a loving mood. And the reality is we all do that.
Mm-hmm.
In our own ways. And sometimes we don't even understand what it is we're doing.
Yeah.
With some of our actions. And watching the two of them interact, it is beautiful.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, because
I would tell you the worst thing was for Obasi, and I think even for the family structure, when Masana went off to university, it was a rough time.
Mm-hmm.
Because his favorite person disappeared and he didn't have an idea of permanence of somebody disappearing.
Right.
It was very challenging for him. He did a little bit of self-injurious behavior. You know, he just was a little bit out of control. And we had to, you know, we had to just buckle down and talk to all his therapists and say, listen, this is what is happening. Tell the school, this is what is happening. He's accustomed to seeing his guy.
Yeah.
And his guy is not there.
Yeah, and because even in the world of technology, right? Even in the world of technology, it's different than you're sitting next to him, you know, you're laying on the same floor, you know, you're going in the car together with mom and dad. It's still different. Like, technology can connect in ways, but it's still missing.
Yeah, and he really wasn't accepting of it. And, you know, the first sign to me that he understood it was when Masana went off for the start of his second year at university. And the night that he went off, Obasi cried. And
he doesn't cry.
He doesn't cry.
He doesn't, right? He wept.
He cried. And it was completely consistent with what a typical child would do. And it suggested a real understanding of what was going on, right? Because before it was more like, okay, he's gone, right? He's gone to the airport, we sent him off. And then next day, first thing in the morning, Obasi's in Masana's bedroom looking for him, right? He clearly didn't fully grasp what was going on or fully didn't accept what was going on. But in the second year, he got it. Yeah. And from then, it became a lot easier. So now, you know, Masana comes in, he goes out, and Obasi kind of understands the routine, understands he's going to see him again, understands we're going to talk on the phone, and that's going to essentially be our substitute until he's physically.
Yeah, I imagine that was quite the challenge because of how close-knit the family is.
Yeah.
You know, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, how this impacts you guys as a couple, right? Because when you're parenting a child that's on the spectrum, that has special needs, it can place very unique pressures on a marriage that maybe other couples don't know and may never be able to understand. But how have you learned to support each other as husband and wife through this journey?
You know, I think in a way you have to learn by doing. There's no question that, honestly, any stress related to your children is going to be problematic. And all of us react to stress in ways that are imperfect. But, you know, I think understanding yourself is important, right? Because sometimes we don't think about why we're doing what we're doing.
This is true.
And with that understanding, it allows you to sort of reach out to the other person more. It certainly hasn't been always easy. You know, if Obasi is going through a particularly trying time, then the whole family is going through this trying time, all of us, right? But, you know, like, there's a lot, you know, in all our lives, we have to have offer grace to the other person, forgiveness. And once you can keep those top of mind, you have a good chance. But there's no question, having a child in it to some spectrum could make it tougher.
Certainly. And Marcus is right, giving grace. And sometimes it's just knowing I might be frustrated with you today, but the love is there. I'm just really frustrated with you today.
Yeah.
And I think that that happens in all marriages. It's just a little bit more intense when you have, you're being pulled hither and fro, you know, based on the needs of your child. But you have to be intentional. You have to... like one of the things that we implemented recently, Marcus and I, is having a couple weekend away, and we get all the assistance for Obasi and Masana if he's there, but just for Obasi, and he and I take a plane and we go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And just to reconnect and to be ourselves as opposed to being the parents of Obasi and Masana. Right. You know, just to take a moment. And it's not something, I think it's something we continue to work on. We are not by any means the most out there, social, all over the place couple that we might have been when we were younger. But, you know, it's about trying and keep trying.
Yeah.
And try something else. Yeah. And, you know, try to make it work.
Yeah. I imagine that, you know, the general ideas the same as a lot of other couples, but like you mentioned, it's that heightened part when you do have a child that's on the spectrum, because there are concerns, there are challenges, there are just these unique parts that come into play that don't necessarily come in other marriages. And I agree. I think that idea of, you know, because I think sometimes people will hear that and be like, well, how could you do that, right? But then it's at the same time, but you, in order for you guys to be good for one another and also good for your children, you have to be able to connect and disconnect from, you know, the world and connect with each other. And I think that is something that's important in every marriage, but especially when you're talking about navigating, you know, this circumstance, it becomes even more critical, because then that's the only way everybody survives. You know, you guys have lived a fair amount of time navigating this journey. What would you say that, like, extended family, churches, schools, friends, the wider community, what can they do to better support families that are raising children who are on the spectrum?
Wow. I mean, I think awareness is key. I think I read in the newspaper recently that the Defense Force had an autism awareness training session. The reality is everyone in every sphere of life could come into contact with someone with autism. And having a bit of an understanding of what that is, what it looks like, what it means, can just make those interactions a lot better. Certainly we do, I vividly recall that we had an environment that we had put Obasi in when he was very young, that did not understand him. And it, you know, it was very uncomfortable for the family. And in the end we said, okay, let's move from here. Let's go, let's go somewhere else. Because, you know, and it wasn't that he was that disruptive, but he was different. And you're just not appreciating that difference. Let it be in an uncomfortable environment.
Obasi is 17. Adulthood is at the doorstep. What hopes, concerns, preparations are in your minds and on your hearts for whatever the next phase of life looks like?
I think the biggest thing that would be on any autism parent's mind as their child navigates through teenagerhood to adulthood is the constancy of care when we are gone. There, I mean, Obasi is a big, strong dude, healthy by all accounts. He will outlive us. And so it is trying to figure out how best we could prepare for that eventuality so it doesn't all fall on his brother. It's a lot of planning, Alex. It's just the
and you know, honestly, you know, I feel like I can't die, you know.
You know, I see that a lot on autism forums, you know, parents saying, I want the day I die to be the day after my son goes. You know, you want to make sure, you know, it is a worrying thing. I think it takes up a lot of headspace of a lot of the parents that I talk to who have children his age or older. What is going to happen?
And obviously I don't mean that I'm literally expecting to be immortal, right? But
it's the feeling you have. Because
it is difficult.
Because you sit back and you think and you're like, you know, despite any challenges that you guys have had, may have had as a family navigating it, you will also always feel like there's nobody who can do this better for my kid than me and my wife, than me and my husband. And so because of that feeling, I imagine there is a lot of fretting. And like you said, you know, you plan as best you can, because you don't want it to just be, okay, Masana has to now navigate this on his own. So it is, like I said, I imagine, like you said, I can understand why it's a comment that you see on a lot of the forums, because it's like, how am I supposed to mentally, physically, emotionally prepare for the concept that, you know, I may be gone and my child is on the spectrum, is left in the world, and I don't want it to be on his own.
And so you got to think, as a parent, you got to think about the extended family. So you think about, you know, my siblings, Paula's siblings.
Cousins.
Cousins, friends.
Because not everybody has a disposition.
You are right.
This is
100% true.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Right? So you think, okay, what, you know, and then for him, you know, he's still going to be in school for a while. But at certain point, he's going to have to transition.
Yeah.
And what does that look like? Figuring out how to still maintain a routine for him, productive and healthy for him. I don't anticipate work being on Obasi's future.
Right.
Many parents of children with autism can't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
For ours, I don't think so. So figuring out how to give him a routine and a space to essentially feel good about himself and productive and so on is also pretty important. And it's one of the things that, we're trying to figure out.
Yeah. You know,
it's a figure outable kind of thing. We're on the road.
Yeah. You know, you raise an interesting point, though, because, I feel like conversations like this give people an opportunity to think beyond what we normally do. So I think for most people, the conversation sits around how do we support the child? How do we support the family? But perhaps there needs to be more conversation about how do we create communities for, children who are on the spectrum, especially if they are, on the more severe end of it. Is there a space that can be created where they can have routine and they can have normalcy that exists beyond their parents' lifespan, where they can feel safe? And then you can feel like, there's a space. And, perhaps that's a conversation that needs to happen in terms of in terms of financing, in terms of legislation, things like that, because this is how I think in some instances you have people where there's, no financial ability to plan, and so you're not really sure what's going to happen. But I think that may be a conversation to have. What can be done to create a community that exists, to assist when it gets to that stage?
Yeah, you're very right. So we're very fortunate as a family. We're both working professionals. We can care for our son. We have to start planning for him and thinking beyond the day-to-day. But there are families who don't have those advantages and really struggle with figuring out, how am I going to care for this child, right? If you don't have enough school placings, if you don't have enough vocational activities and stuff for them to do, it could be extremely daunting if you're more in a day-to-day type mode.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult. And it becomes a societal problem if the family can't handle it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
That becomes then I won't call it a burden, but it does affect society. If it is, we have people who are just falling through the cracks.
Yeah,
and you see it. I mean, because we have been around people on the spectrum, sometimes, honestly, we're driving along the road and you see a dispossessed person, living on the street, and you look at him, you look at the quirks, and you go, oh, that person has autism.
Mm-hmm.
The people probably just passed on.
Yeah.
And there was no plan.
Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge. We live in a space where so many of our people are living check to check. And so, like you said, that presents a challenge in and of itself, because how do I even financially plan for what happens when I'm gone?
Exactly.
If I'm literally just, if that check doesn't come in next week, I'm not sure if we're going to eat. I'm not sure if we're going to have a roof over our head. I think it becomes very difficult to navigate that. And then it does become a concern for the society of large. I don't want to use the word burden. It does become a concern, though, for the society at large.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As we wrap up, I think two big questions I want to ask before we go. What would you guys say to another parent or parents who may be at the beginning of this journey and feel overwhelmed, afraid, or unsure of what comes next? What advice would you give them? What words of wisdom would you give them?
I would say that don't feel overwhelmed. As difficult as that sounds mentally, right? If someone panics and you tell them don't panic, you're usually not telling them something. Yeah, it's not that productive, right? But the reality is we do need to be centered enough to understand that our emotions are things that we feel and that we experience, but they don't have to be a prison for us.
Yeah.
And, sometimes the stress is associated with a feeling of longing You know, I had my mental image of who my child was, and my child is someone different, mm-hmm. right? And I want to hold on to that image of who that child was. And sometimes it's just because you are lost, right? I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
How can I get to the right place for me and my child? And both of those things can be addressed.
Yeah.
But it starts with recognizing that I have a challenge. I'm not the first to have this challenge. There are lots of successful stories out there that can give me hope and give me a roadmap. Mm-hmm. Maybe I could follow in their footsteps, right? This is, as Paula said earlier, figure outable.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it, right? But it starts with just sort of just centering yourself a bit.
Accepting it, actually.
Yes. Allow yourself to feel the emotions,
mm-hmm.
right? You can't just put those away. Those are real and they exist. Allow yourself to feel them, but don't be imprisoned by them.
Yeah, don't get stuck there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And just start taking one step. You're not going to figure it out in a day or a month or a year. That's not going to happen. You take one step and then yes. you take another.
Mm-hmm.
And
I keep moving forward.
You keep moving forward.
Trying things. I mean, I would tell somebody who just got their diagnosis, listen, the internet is your friend.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when you can't figure it out and the people around you don't have any experience with it, do a search.
Mm-hmm.
Start somewhere. There is so much more information available on things to do, how to try to do this, how to do this. And, you know, just feeling that you are doing something, even if you're not doing it perfectly, in the aid of your child is a good start.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's enough to kind of keep you going. Like you said, it's one foot in front of the other, one day at a time, one step at a time. When you look back over the years to this point, what are you most grateful for?
I have two happy, healthy children who are well-adjusted,
mm-hmm.
who are loved, and who are very much capable of loving. And while one is going to have a more complicated future than the other, I'm extremely grateful for where they are now. I'm very positive that they're going to continue to be happy and healthy, and hopefully I can play a part in ensuring that. We have come a long way as a family, and I'm proud of what both me, my wife, and our older son, Masana, has done to help us get there. And I'm very optimistic about it.
Anything else you want to add, Paula?
No, I think Marcus said it perfectly. I mean, at the end of the day, we have two wonderful boys,
mm-hmm.
young men, who are capable of doing great things in their own way. And we as a family are here to support them, our extended family, you know, mm-hmm. friends. We don't discount help regardless. It doesn't have to be family. It can be mm-hmm. friends. It can be teachers. It could be, you know, we are extremely grateful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've been surrounded by a good community. I mean, anybody who knows us well knows Obasi,
yeah.
everybody. Mm-hmm. And there's always been outpouring of love and affection from everybody in our lives.
Awesome.
So very grateful.
I want to thank you guys both so much for, one, taking time out of your busy schedule, but also, two, being willing and open to share your story of navigating the world of being a parent with a child who's on the autism spectrum. It does take a certain amount of bravery to be willing to kind of share and go into some of the depths of what you've faced, the challenges you've overcome, you've worked through together as a family. So I want to thank you so much for joining us on Vital Voices today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. So thank you again to our guests, Marcus Boslin and Paula Maria Hospitalis Boslin, for joining us on Vital Voices and sharing such a personal and meaningful part of their family's journey. Today's conversation reminds us that autism is not just a topic to be understood clinically or educationally. It is also a lived experience within families. It touches parenting, marriage, sibling relationships, schooling, community support, advocacy, and the hopes parents carry for their children's future. For families navigating a similar journey, we hope this conversation reminds you that you are not alone. Your love, your patience, and your commitment matter. And for the wider community, may we all be challenged to listen more carefully, judge less quickly, and create more compassionate spaces for children and families with different needs. And thank you to all of you for listening to Vital Voices. Until next time, stay informed, stay connected, stay well, and stay tuned for the next Vital Voice.
Did you miss a part of today's show? You can catch this episode and all Vital Voices episodes online at youtube.com/@VitalVoices242. See you next week as we sit down with another Vital Voice.
Vital Voices is a production of Tag Studios and is proudly brought to you each week by our sponsor, Wellspring Lifestyle Group, where you can find freedom and transformation through whole person health.
Vital Voices.